Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Let's now go to Cairo, Egypt. I'm speaking with Samia Sarageldin, who's a writer, political essayist, editor, and literary critic. She was born and raised in Egypt, educated in Europe, and then emigrated to the United States. Her autobiographical novel, The Cairo House, traces political developments in Egypt over the past three decades, including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination. She joins us today from Cairo. And thank you for joining us again, giving us an update on where we stand today. It seems that Mubarak is holding on. His inner circle is diminishing. His cronies are fleeing in their private jets with all their loot. The students and the young people are not leaving the streets. The military is on the streets. The police have disappeared. The police may well be behind the looting. I'd like to ask you about that, actually. Why don't we begin with that? Is it true, as we've heard, that the police are either turning a blind eye or actively involved in looting? And is the regime letting people out of jail in order to create chaos so that they can turn around and say, you need us to bring law and order?
That seems to be the general perception. First, the lack of police presence in the streets was very much in response to the demands of the demonstrators and of everybody, because the police were generally anathema, very, very unpopular because of so many incidents of police brutality, not just against the Muslim Brotherhood and organizations like that, but just in general. And the chief, not the chief of police, but the Minister of the Interior, who controls the police in Egypt, was very, very much a hated figure in Egypt. And that's why the Ministry of Interior has been under attack day after day and is cordoned off by the military and under protection. So the police were taken off the streets because the crowds were attacking them, not physically attacking them, but calling for their being taken off the streets, and they were taken off the streets at first in response to popular demand. But the lack of police presence also meant that the criminal elements in society, particularly since the three major prisons outside, most of the prisons are in the outskirts of Cairo, but the three major prisons have prisoners have been released, the prisons have been attacked, the prisoners have been released, including, of course, the criminal element. It is widely believed that this could only happen with the collusion of the authorities, and the intention is to heighten the sense of insecurity, which so far has been minimized by the very comforting neighborhood committees that have been set up in every street, every building, every alley, and they've been largely responsible for keeping the peace on the streets. The curfew has been very early, 4 o'clock in the afternoon yesterday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon today, but it's been to some extent ignored, certainly where the major protests are taking place, like Tahrir Square. Curfew is entirely ignored, but otherwise it's more or less observed. And again, it's the neighborhood watch committees who are enforcing some kind of policing presence. But here and there, the military also has come in response to calls for shooting, or where there seems to be a danger. People have been given numbers. There are certain numbers that have been broadcast that you can call, and the military police or the military will come in response to those calls, but not the police. That's been the status, which is very unusual for it to be military who come into neighborhoods in response to complaints from citizens that there is danger or that there's looting. Otherwise, it's mostly, as I said, just people, residents in buildings, doorkeepers as well, shopkeepers, domestics, businessmen, students, lawyers, doctors, the men mostly, take to the streets at night and take shifts holding whatever they have, broomsticks or cudgels, or largely, by and large, the Egyptian population is not an armed one. And so these citizens are at a disadvantage compared to the criminal elements who occasionally are armed and who have been looting police stations, because police stations all over the country have been attacked. And the arms that were in the police stations have been obtained by the attackers. And so, but in spite of that, by and large, there have been no horrific incidents. Many incidents, but none that were very horrific in nature, which could have been the case otherwise.
Well, we know, for example, Samir Sarageldin, that it was the army that captured the criminals who broke into the National Museum and desecrated a couple of mummies. The idea that that Egypt's historical thousands years of treasures could be desecrated is pretty horrific. We know that happened in Iraq with the so-called liberation of Iraq. So what is your feeling about Mohammed al-Baradei? Is he, as the young reporter from Alexandria told us earlier, is he the man of the moment to the Egyptian people?
A lot of people would like to see that in him, but at the same time have reservations, not about him as a person. He's generally extremely respected, well-respected, but many people feel that his moment has passed or that events have overtaken him because he was abroad for so long. And because as soon as he came to Egypt, he was basically put under house arrest. And so the feeling that although he himself as a person is widely admired for his integrity, for his honorability, but there's the feeling that he may not be the man of the moment. The Muslim Brotherhood have offered to have him, to support him in elections and such, which of course does not at all fit his profile. He is an extremely secular man, but in general, the feeling is that it would have been Baradei's moment to seize a few months ago. Now it's not clear that it is his moment to seize. Although, like the other, like the young reporter that you spoke to, most secular, educated, progressive people, like most of the demonstrators on the streets, are of that ilk. Would like to see Baradei come to power, but it's not clear that he has the. For one thing, he does not have the backing of the army, and since he has no power base in the country, he would need probably the endorsement of the army or its backing to come to power. So there, again, it's not clear that that is a viable outcome.
So Mia Sarageldin, again, the author of the Cairo House, which traces the political developments in Egypt over the last three decades, including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination. She's joining us from Cairo. If Egypt follows the Tunisian model, where you had the young people took to the streets, they drove out the dictator and the kleptocrat and his crooked family and cronies, and then the military stepped into the vacuum, and that's where we stand today, where the real power broker in Tunisia is the very popular general. And it's not unlikely that a similar scenario is going to unfold in Egypt, at least that's the way I see it. Given that the only institution left that the people have any respect for is the military, presumably there would be a transition and then some kind of election. If there were, so walk me through those two possibilities. One, an interim military government, and two, elections. And if the elections were held, who do you think would win?
Well, a military transition is I think almost inevitably the the scenario here, because in a power vacuum, the military takes over, and in Egypt, it's very much the case, even right now, that the military are the ones on the streets. And at the moment, there's a honeymoon period with the mass of the people, and certainly with the protesters and the protesters. They actually feel safer with the military on the streets, and so do average citizens. Now, whether or not it would be an interim government is the question here. The military came to power 60 years ago now, with Nasser and that coup d'etat. And today, the military have had 60 years of entrenched privileges. And many, many of the military top brass and in general have become very wealthy, very privileged, very entrenched. Whether they would willingly set aside these privileges and just hand over power is not clear. That's one scenario. Now, free and fair elections, that is one thing that is non-negotiable on the streets of Cairo at the moment. And if they did happen, again, you would have the parties that are currently organized. Naturally, since they are currently organized, they would probably make a good showing in the elections. However, the bogeyman scenario that the Mubarak regime had been throwing out at every opportunity, that if free and fair elections, the Muslim Brotherhood would automatically take over the country, that is not going to happen. They are organized. They are one of the better organized parties, although not an official party. They're officially illegal. But even if they were to become legal, or they field candidates at any rate, but they will certainly make a good showing simply because they are organized. But they are highly unlikely to carry off free and fair elections, because the street has shown that that is not where the people are. That's not where the power base is. They do not have the leadership to lead the country. They do not have any charismatic leaders. So they will make a showing, but they will not. It will not be the scenario that has been put forth, and is still being put forth by various media and to some extent by the Mubarak regime on its last legs, that without Mubarak, it's the Muslim Brotherhood who will take over the country.
Well, just in closing,
go on.
Just in closing then, Samir Sarigeldin, given that the tear gas canisters that are being fired at the protesters are stamped with Made in the USA, and our previous guest, the young reporter with Youth Journalism International from Alexandria, was saying that the Egyptian people are very upset with President Barack Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for failing to back them, and the Americans must choose between the Egyptian people and the government. Is that a widespread feeling?
I'm afraid it is. I'm very much afraid it is. Any American reporters on the ground will tell you that they themselves, as Americans, face no hostility. People like them as Americans, as people. But that there is a perception that U.S. policy, not just today, but for decades now, has been entirely centered around the security of Israel, and that Egypt and the Egyptian people and their aspirations have not mattered to American foreign policy. What has mattered is a strong regime that could guarantee the security of Israel, a strong regime in Egypt that could guarantee the security of Israel, and that therefore the aspirations of the Egyptian people, the repression that they have been going through, 30 years of martial law, all of that has not mattered. And so you can have the resentment of a people that feel that for all these decades, they have not mattered in the least, and what has mattered is for American foreign policy is something entirely different. So there is that resentment. But all it would take is for the U.S. to show that democracy is not just a slogan, that democracy is not just democracy when it delivers results that the U.S. Certain policy prerogatives, for that perception to change. I think Secretary Clinton's remarks and remarks by other world leaders that that democracy per se or elections, free and fair elections per se, may not be the priority of the West or of the U.S. or of U.S. foreign policy. Those are not helpful remarks, but there's no animosity against Americans as such. I think any Americans, any reporters, any tourists who are on the streets of Cairo or any Egyptian city will confirm that they never face any personal hostility. There's nothing personal about it. It's a question of decades of policy.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today on Background Briefing. Samia Sarageldin, again, author of the autobiographical novel The Cairo House, which traces the political developments in Egypt over the past three decades, including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination. And she joins us today from Cairo. Again, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back joined by the Arab League's former ambassador to the US and the UN.